Great. Good morning, guys. Firstly, let me thank Mark as well as Erie for giving me this opportunity to be a part of this conference. So, right, going right into the topic, what you can see here is you have quite a lot of crops which are lined up over here, and then if you see the amount of people in terms of millions which are depending upon a rice, as you can see here, if you look more closely into Southeast and Southeast Asia over here, you would see that nearly 460 million people who live on less than $1.25 a day come from these areas where rice is the most dominant crop. So I wouldn't be wrong by saying that rice basically could itself be sort of a food security for Asia. So what I'm going to try and do is concentrate most of my talk on rice, basically that what you would have expected anyway right from the beginning. Right, this graph shows where we are and where we want to be at 2035. The demographic figures come from the United Nations, whereas the income projections comes from the IFPRI. So putting together what you can see from this slide over here is, over the years as we pass towards the 2035 mark, there is going to be a huge increase in demand for rice, especially in the Asian countries, as you can see here. The other more dominant area that would require more rice over the coming years is Africa, as you can see here. I want to tell that this data which is put ahead or put front of you is not based on the paddy yields, it's on the milled rice, because we feel that paddy itself cannot be eaten by people. So basically all this data which is represented is in the case of milled rice. So we have in front of us this demand which we have to fulfill by 2035, and over the past 2 to 3 days we have heard many speakers who have said that we would have less land, less labor, etc. On top of that, overlaying, we have this global climate change which is much more of a bigger threat. So if you see in this slide where we got to put together a few of these elements in one of the recently published review, if you look at some of the studies, there's always going to be a positive effect of increased CO2 per se because of increased photosynthesis or water use efficiency or the total biomass. So if you take CO2 itself, obviously you will have a much positive impact. But then on the other side, if you see, this increased CO2 also results in an increased temperature, which then leads into a cascade of events that you can see here with respect to precipitation changes as well as the sea level rising. So these in turn results in more droughts, salinity and flooding. And the other aspect of the direct impact of this temperature is also that it impacts the respiratory losses as well as the spikelet sterility. Now, as you know, given this topic of talking about food security in the whole of Asia, or the food production in Asia, is a huge topic to be covered in the 25 minutes. So what I will do is I'll concentrate my talk or focus it mostly on the abiotic stresses, as I've shown here, and the progress that we have achieved at Erie respect to these different abiotic stresses. So I have lined those abiotic stresses which I'm going to talk about and also give you, I wouldn't be able to do complete justice to these topics because these are huge areas and many different groups at Erie is working on each of these aspects. So what I'll give it to you is the progress that we have achieved and the highlights, and in case you have anything to discuss, we could also obviously do that after my talk. And then I'll move on to talk about the companion stresses. Well, basically, we do a lot of work on these independent stresses, temperature, drought, etc. But when you move on to the field, basically, they exist together. You have this combination of stresses which happens at the time. So what are we doing with respect to that? And then recently formed global alliance, which are formed between different centers. I'm going to talk about GRISP, which is a global rice science partnership. I've flagged this up just to tell you that there are different groups which are working in the areas that I'm going to talk about, and in case you would want to have more details about anything, or if you want to work, collaborate, or get material from these teams, please feel free to contact them, and yeah, that's about it. So moving on to the first aspect is the temperature stresses. So basically, there are two different approaches that Erie follows with respect to temperatures. One is a heat escape approach, and one is the heat tolerance or a truly heat tolerant approach. When I say heat escape, what do I mean? Basically, in this figure on the x-axis, you see the time of the day, and then the y-axis, you see the temperature. On z-axis, the proportion of the spikelets which are opening in a day. Most of the cultivated species would open during the, or the peak flowering happens during 10 or 12 o'clock in the morning, where the temperatures are pretty high, and then resulting in sterility. So the main objective of our, or this strategy, is to try and move this peak flowering towards the early parts of the morning where the temperatures will be much cooler, and then you would reduce sterility. So we tried to do this, and looking up at the gene bank that we have at Erie, we put up nearly 4,000 different accessions in the field conditions. But unfortunately, the level of genetic diversity that we were looking for was not available in the cultivated species. But then one of our colleagues, Tom Ishimaru, was able to identify this trait in Oryza officinalis. After that, this trait was introgressed into Koshiakari, where the flowering was advanced to 2.5 hours towards the morning. I'll give you some of the highlights of the paper, which has recently been published. On the top part of it, you could see that this is the number of open spikelets, and this is the time of the day. And for convenience, I would tell you to focus on these solid symbols, where the solid circles indicates Koshiakari, which is a wild type, where the flowering happens at around 10 to 11 o'clock, whereas that of the EMF line, which is the early morning flowering line, which basically is Koshiakari, but just as a fragment from Oryza officinalis, flowers at 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning. You could see the impact on this in the spikelet fertility over here, wherein Koshiakari, which had majority of the spikelets flowering later on, results in greater sterility. And this picture here indicates exactly what I've been telling. You can see that the flowering starts very early in the morning and then escapes stress. As you can see in the watch, which is designated, which is like 6:40, it starts to flower. And the second approach we try to deal with is with respect to that of temperature, is try and identify true heat tolerance. Heat escape to a certain extent is good for immediate concern, but there are other developmental stages in rice which has to be taken care of, or you need true heat tolerance. So not only with these different genotypes, but we have got lots, nearly 60 to 70 different genotypes from around the world tested, but none of them has performed as good as this tolerant entry N22. And apart from just the flowering stage, this variety has been tested in detail for microsporogenesis stage, as well as for high night temperatures, both on the field and in controlled conditions. And all these four cases, N22 is performing very good. So what does that mean is, any genetics or the molecular work that we are doing with N22 could still have a spillover effect into different developmental stages as well. To give you a snapshot of the different physiological processes we do, we start off with something with the anther dehiscence, detailed physiological analysis during anthesis to try and see the reason behind the resistance or the tolerance or the susceptibility across different genotypes. As you can see, we start off with doing with the anther dehiscence to try and see what happens with the pollination process, then the pollen grain deposition and the viability of the pollen and fertility. So this is a sort of a routine process which happens at Irina team. So once you have tested this and you have these entries, basically, then we do have the QTL process, which we do, and then as you can see, it is done with different mapping populations, and then the consistent QTLs go through to the fine mapping process. Apart from that, we do have something of the proteomics we do, which is a two-dimensional fluorosis method where the candidate genes are identified. And then these candidate genes are tested basically to look at the qPCR level or the rt-PCR, a temporal spatial analysis. And then we try to get these and then do the functional analysis. So the point is, you would get this material, you would test them, you identify QTLs, you get these genes, and basically you also have the material transformed into the background that you want. But you need a location to test these materials. So we work closely with the GIS team to identify locations where we could test some of these varieties. I'm going to give you some examples why we need to do this exercise. This is one location in Bangladesh where the temperatures during flowering or early grain filling is 35 degrees centigrade, where the relative humidity is 60%. Yeah. at the same stage where the crop is in Pakistan, the temperatures are 40 or higher than 40 degrees centigrade, but the relative humidity is 20%. So what happens under these? You would expect that the temperatures of 40 degrees would have more effect on rice. In fact, it's the opposite, because temperatures have a very strong interaction with relative humidity. So based on the VPD, what we do is we then go into these hotspot locations, then start to identify these locations, and whatever breeding material which comes out from the breeding teams is tested for either the hot, dry, and the hot, humid conditions, so that it is not a generic approach, but then more specific approach for region-based breeding approach. There's quite a lot of talk these days with the high night temperature story. All that I said before was with respect to the high day temperatures. There has been some, there are quite a few papers which are coming out recently, but most of this work has been coming from controlled environment chambers. What you see in this slide is all three studies have come from the field conditions, all where IRI was involved, and two of them are very high impact papers as well. Both of these were published in PNAS. What you can see is in a very narrow range of temperature, you see a greater decline in yields and in biomass as well. But the same is not being replicated under controlled conditions. So we feel that there is a gap, and we are trying to do this more. So we have moved, and we have facilities now at IRI to try and test this under field conditions much more rigorously. Then moving on to the drought stress, the drought stream has two different strategies, as you can see from here. One is a conventional approach and the other one is a molecular approach. Previously, there used to be quite a lot of work done with the secondary traits and to try and improve drought tolerance. But I think 6 or 7 years ago, they started to look for yield as one of the traits, the direct selection for yield under drought conditions. And then we have had quite a lot of success, which I'm going to show in your next slide. But then during one of these talks, I also heard that some of the drought material that you develop shouldn't be a cacti. What they mean is they should be able to survive drought, should be able to give yield, but then under non-stress conditions should still give equivalent amount like any other variety which is grown recently. And then this material which comes out, we tested in a very wide range of drought breeding network that we have, which spreads across Asia, South Asia, and Africa as well. And the molecular approaches, as you would have seen, even with heat stress, this is, we try to identify QTLs and then introgress these QTLs. And we use land races as well as wild type, wild rises to try and identify these QTLs. And there's a team which works on the physiological aspects like roots and stomatal conductance, etc., and different molecular mechanisms with and without these QTLs and the reason why those changes are happening. To show you some of the recent results that our team has obtained is here. You can see in both lowland as well as in upland drought, you see some of these lines which have been bred using the conventional method. These have nearly 88 to 100% percent increase with the best check. But then what is interesting also is under non-stress condition, it performs equally like any other variety. So this is what I meant to say, that it should be able to perform under drought, but still has the ability. It's a sort of an insurance to the rice crop that the drought kicks in, then the QTL or the gene should be able to respond. If it is not there, then it shouldn't take the resources from the plant away. It's the same with respect to that of the upland drought as well, as you can see. Very clear. The other thing that this team does is it involves farmers right in different stages of the product development. It's not that the product is developed and then we have the farmers involved, but then there are different traits and characters which are liked by different people, and then these are picked all along the way. As you can see, we have good participatory varietal trials which goes on selection based using the farmers' practice. This is what has come out with the molecular approaches. As I would say, I wouldn't do justice because this is just one slide, but the amount of work that has gone into it is humongous. The all these DTY, what it represents is different QTLs which have been obtained, and these have been obtained from different mapping populations, many number of seasons, locations as well, all in Asia as well as in Philippines. So the idea is they are trying to bring these together in different combinations to try and see if they have additive effect or if they have complementary effect, and trying to see which would fit best. And then, as you can see here, using these process, we have already been able to achieve like molecular breeding up to 1.5 tons per hectare, which is a significant increase under drought stress conditions. I'll move on to the submergence and salinity. I've clubbed both of them. With the submergence tolerance, this has been one of the landmark achievements at Erie, with the submergence tolerance and the sub-1 gene, which basically, following the same, this was the achievement wherein all the other stresses followed the same suit. So this was a major QTL which was identified on chromosome 9, and as you can see, when the fine mapping exercise was done, basically it had three important genes, sub-1 A, B, and C. Basically, sub-1 A is a gene which gives this tolerance into these traits, and this has been identified, cloned, and we have the gene. And the most important part is the gene which has been identified has been then transformed or introgressed into 6 different mega varieties. Mega varieties are grown in millions of hectares, so it has a huge importance when it compares to that of food production or food security, Asia or elsewhere in the world. And then you can see that all these 6 varieties have been released in these countries, and many more varieties are on the pipeline to be released. What you can see in this picture is a fantastic one. All these varieties which you see, a green patches, are all these varieties which had a sub-1 in them, and these were all submerged for 14 days. And only the ones which had sub-1, you can see them. But it's not by mistake that these are not planted, but they just didn't survive at all for the flooding. The other area is the anaerobic germination. The submergence kicks in when you have already transplanted your seedling, but then when you have direct seeding where you just put the seed in, then it's very important during irrigated and rain-fed conditions to have anaerobic germination, and it is pretty independent of the submergence. So as you can see here from this figure, FR13A was a donor for the submergence tolerance, but then this performs very poorly under anaerobic germination, and then we have another very good donor which has been identified. And using that donor, again, the QTL on a chromosome 9 was identified. It's a different QTL from the submergence QTL, but it is 6 MB away from the submergence. So there's basically no interaction between these two QTLs. The process which was followed, as you can see here, thousands of lines were tested before they decided to go ahead with this entry for doing the QTL analysis. And now that region has been fine mapped, and they have just 5 genes which they are now concentrating and think that they could still go ahead with as a similar story as that of the submergence. I've got a single slide on salinity just to say that we follow the same protocol, and we have a very dominant QTL on the chromosome 1, which explains nearly 40% of the genetic variation. But this is only for the vegetative stage salinity tolerance. So recently we have had phenotyping protocol which is developed to test for the reproductive stage as well. And in this process we have identified some QTLs, and we plan to introgress both the seedling stage as well as the reproductive stage salinity tolerance. Well, I'll skip through this because it's the same procedure that we follow. Well, this is an interesting bit, because we do have people working on different components like temperature and drought, but then some of this material was taken onto the field and in some cases it just failed. Because under field condition there are many other interacting factors, and some of these abiotic structures interact very strongly among each other. As you can see here, this figure here shows when the crop is under flowering stage or the early grain filling stage, and these are at the brink of being affected by temperature. Same regions are susceptible to drought stress as well. So there are chances that both these stresses can occur at the same time. And we also know physiologically that these both interact very closely with each other. And the other one is a drought and submergence story. It's because when you have these submergence, in the initial stages you do get submergence because there's a lot of water and the flooding. But later on, during the later parts or the later duration, you don't have enough rainfall, and then you have terminal drought stress. So this was the case in some of the fields. So then the idea was to incorporate the drought tolerance QTLs, as you can see here, which has a positive QTL. The positive QTLs were then transformed into sub-1 lines, which then had both drought and the submergence tolerance. And along the same lines, we have submergence salinity tolerant lines. The reason behind this, why this is being pursued, is because when you have the submergence along the coastal areas, you get the water coming in, it floods the rice crop, but it's just not water, it's saline water which it is there. So basically, you need a combination of submergence and tolerance. I see the protocol which is done here was a huge tank with salinity water, and then onto the field where it is salinized. And you see the sub one, when it has saline water submergence, it doesn't perform well. And hence, with a combination of salinity as well as a submergence, it's performing much, much better. So this is along the lines that we are seeing and looking at the different combinations of stresses that's happening. This is, again, an interaction between salinity with the relative humidity. If you see here, as you go on increasing the salinity levels and then start decreasing the relative humidity, you see that it is completely affected. You can imagine what is going to happen if it, again, combines with temperature stresses. Right, so those were basically, so I don't know how many minutes. Oh, right, okay. I can explain quite a bit of this then. Right, so that was some of the highlights which we are doing in case of all the major abiotic stresses. I apologize that I cannot put everything over there, but I hope I would have given you a sort of an highlight or a snapshot of the activities. Last year, there was a huge effort which was put in across different rice research institutes across the world, and this year this was approved as one of the thematic area 3. It is called as a Global Rice Science Partnership. This is basically an open and an evolving partnership, and anybody who is interested to join this partnership can easily do so. What it means is all these centers, IRI, which takes the lead in this and which is mainly taking care of the Asian component, Africa Rice takes care of the African component, and CIAR takes care of Latin America. And then we have different partners, CIRAD, IRG, JIRCAS, whatever. But the point is, all these people work together, and this now has become a partnership where we start to share material, seeds, etc., and all the outcomes of these are all directed to single product or the single product line. So there's several of this product line, and we aim to reach these product lines. So basically, it's a collective effort across different centers across the world. So this we are very excited about, and this was initiated only this year. We look forward to this. Well, finally, coming to a close, I would like to thank Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the USAID and BMZ, who have been the main donors for most of the work that I have presented here, but there are many other donors who are funding other aspects which are going on at IRI. And if any of you are interested to see what exactly is in GRISP and what is going on, what are the product lines, and if you want to involve, then I've given you the website over there where you could go and check it out. And finally, I would want to say one thing is the capacity building was a huge thing with respect to GRISP, and then last year 25 PhD openings were sent out, and now they are filled up. So there will be more PhD positions which will be coming up under GRISP, where the students will work across different centers. So it's an opportunity for the youngsters to try and join us to try and solve some of these challenges for food security, not only for Asia, but for the world. Thank you for your attention.